When I was involved in the International Year of the Disabled Person, I met a lot of people who were regarded as so deformed, so ugly, that they were kept away from people or chose to hide away. And one of my most vivid memories is when I walked into an institution, a well-intentioned institution in WA, in Perth, and at the far end of the room was a bloke sitting in a wheelchair, and he was in profile to me. And as I walked towards him, because it was arranged that we were going to talk, as I walked towards him, at the last second he swung the chair around. And I saw that there's really only half of him there. He was a farmer who'd been trapped under a burning tractor, and literally half of him had melted. And he was, you know, my heart went out to him, but he did it quite deliberately to confront me. And then he said, "I can't go out, you know." He said, "If I go down the street like this," he said, "people will jump through plate glass shop windows." Well, if that was the way people felt in Australia just a couple of decades ago, imagine what it was like to be similarly burned to the bone during the Second World War. As I told you a little earlier, during the Battle of Britain, hundreds of adventurous young airmen sustained horrific burns. Their faces were often burned beyond recognition, hands fingerless, unusable, self-esteem in tatters. And although they might be referred to as heroes, at the time it was common to hide them away, because some of these men had to undergo as many as 50 operations, and they needed a place where they could live and feel normal. Now, under the wing of and that's no pun intended, under the wing of the pioneering plastic surgeon Sir Archibald McIndoe, they lived in the East Grinstead Cottage Hospital, but without any of the usual ward restrictions. McIndoe hired nurses with quite specific qualities we'll discuss later, but they included a sense of humour, and boy, did they need them. He organised dances, and he encouraged the East Grinstead community to treat these poor blokes as they would any other young man. Liz Bersky grew up in East Grinstead, and as a little girl was understandably terrified by the sight of these men, and she decided to revisit the UK to meet the surviving members of what was known as the Guinea Pig Club, and also the nurses who looked after them. Liz is a journalist, novelist, broadcaster, and her new book is called In Love and War, Nursing Heroes. And she joins me in the Perth studio. And in this case, once again, I'm in Perth, Australia. Welcome to our little wireless program, Liz.
Thanks, Philip. It's great to be here.
As a six-year-old, these men with terrible faces, missing ears, melted noses, hands without fingers, simultaneously appalled and fascinated you?
They did. And, of course, one of the things that we were told not to do as children was to stare at them. You mustn't stare at them because it was unkind. And, of course, once you're told that, the one thing that you want to do is to look. And staring is such a powerful thing, both for the starer and the person being stared at. I was terrified. And I think, although I talked to other people who were the same age as me, or possibly a little older, I think my parents tried to protect me by not telling me anything about what had happened. You know, we weren't allowed to talk about the war, so I had no understanding really, except great fear that these men had brought the war to my hometown.
But you write about the visit of one particular bloke to your home, and when he spoke to you, you fainted and fell down the stairs.
Yes, my father was bringing this terrifying man into the house, and I had got out of bed because I'd heard my father coming home, and I got out of bed to go to the landing and see if he would come up and say goodnight to me. And he came in, and behind him, this man came in with a purple and crimson face and hugely swollen lips and eyes at different position, different heights on his face, and just stubs for fingers because his hands had been burnt away. And I took off from the top of the stairs and fainted and came to in the hospital where these men were treated. So they have haunted my dreams all my life, even once I understood who they were and how terribly they'd been injured, what they'd been through, and that they could do me no harm, I still used to dream about them.
As the surgical guinea pigs of McIndoe, these men formed their own exclusive guinea pig club, their term, and it only allowed membership to men who had been, quote, mashed, fried or boiled in the air.
That's right. And that mashed, fried and boiled statement, I think, encapsulates the sort of people that the guinea pigs were, and they, the way they used this humour to deal with their situation. And it's a very good description because some of their faces were mashed, boiled and fried. One of them, a guy called Dennis Neal, had all those things happen to him. His face was virtually destroyed. His jawbone went up through the roof of his mouth. He lost most of his nose. His eyes ended up being 2 inches high. Well, one 2 inches higher than the other, and he had burns on his legs. And the treatment, of course, was excruciating, but it was also combined with the horror of what had happened to them and what that would mean for the rest of their lives.
Liz, I well remember stories about the prostheses created during the and after the First World War. There was very little in the way of, plastic surgery. So very often artificial noses or complete face masks were created. But in this case, there is an attempt at surgical restitution.
There is, and this is what was so extraordinary about what McIndoe did during the war. He had worked with Sir Harold Gillies, who had done work on people who had been burned in the First World War. And Gillies had made the first masks, but of course a mask can be just as terrifying to look at as terrible wounds because it doesn't move. It's an extremely scary thing to try and communicate with someone who's wearing a mask that has no movement in it. So what Gillies and McIndoe and one other person were trying to do between the wars was, one, to make it possible to keep people alive after they'd been hideously burned because the chemical balance of the body is destroyed by burning, and most people prior to the late 30s, if they were very badly burned, they did not survive. So they were trying to, one, keep them alive, and two, find ways not just to graft skin but to graft flesh, to grow new chins and noses, and make much bigger steps forward than had been done in the past. And this was where the pedicle came in. And this was...
I'm looking at photos of Jack Toper, who had a pedicle skin graft from his arm to his nose. Explain to the listener what this is.
Well, what they used to do was to take a strip of flesh from the inside of the arm and keep it attached at one end and separated it at round about the just before the elbow on the inside of the arm, and then it was rolled into a tube and stitched together, and then the open end of it was attached to the part of the face which was to be regrown. So in Jack's case, it was his nose, and that was the case for many of these men. And then the arm would be attached to the chest. So they would put his arm in a sling and bandage it up and fix it there for up to 8 weeks to 3 months. Mm. And what happened was that the pedicle that they had created, which actually looks like a trunk that goes from the nose to the arm, this kept the flow of blood alive.
And it did, well, in the case of Jack Toper, it kept his spirit alive because the Jack that you met, you know, a rather handsome gentleman, said that it gave him the will to live and face other people. Look, let's shift the focus to McIndoe now, because how he gets this whole town on side when the government had already decided they need to be hidden at a secret location, he didn't want people feeling sorry for them. So he gets the community leaders together, and as you tell us, he wanted shopkeepers, publicans, customers to be normal with them. And he both chastened and moved the community.
He did indeed. What he did was quite extraordinary, and it's believed to be the first effort to create a therapeutic community. He started off by doing it in the hospital, by the way he recruited nurses and the way he managed staff at the hospital. And once he'd made it very clear what he wanted in the hospital itself, he went out into the town and he just talked to people. He gave public addresses in all sorts of places, in restaurants, in bars, in committee meetings. And he's told the people of East Grinstead, these young men have given their lives for you in just the same way as had they died. And we owe it to them to make them welcome here. Don't stare at them. Don't laugh at them. Don't whisper behind your hand when they're looking at you. Explain to your children. Don't let them laugh or point. Every mirror in the town was taken down so that the men would never catch sight of themselves inadvertently. Because you see, Philip, the interesting thing was that while they were undergoing all these operations, they weren't otherwise ill. They had to be at the hospital in between operations most of the time, but they could live there and go in round about in the town. He wanted them to feel safe and to feel as though they were among friends. And the town absolutely responded in the most extraordinary way. People asked them into their homes. There were darts matches and musical evenings and cricket matches. And young women were brought into dances to dance with them and go on outings with them. He believed that these men must feel accepted. And, of course, it worked. They were able to go into the town to walk about. People would smile at them, stop and chat to them, and they felt at home. Of course, it was very difficult for them when they went outside the town, when they went home perhaps to stay with their families or up to London to go to the theatre or something like that.
Well, Jack Taper pointed out it was bloody impossible for them to get jobs, but he was nonetheless very glad he was a guinea pig. Now, let's talk about the origins of the club, because it was, I learned from you, Liz, born in the wake of a very big night on the tiles.
It was, yes. One of the things that McIndoe did for his men in the hospital was that there was always a barrel of beer there in the hospital ward, another way of, you know, dissolving the boundaries and all the protocols that were current at the time were cast aside by McIndoe. So there was always beer on the ward and there was a lot of joking and laughing. And if the men were at a stage in their treatment when they could go out at night, then they used to go up into town to the pub and get very drunk and come back waving the perhaps the street lanterns from the roadworks and singing and waking up other patients. Anyway, they had a big night like this, and one morning several of them wandered across into a little hut that was by the ward and started talking, and they decided to form a club. And they've called it, first of all, the Maxillonian Club, because of to name it after the facial surgery, the maxillosurgery that they'd had. But later it became the Guinea Pig Club because they called themselves McIndoe's guinea pigs, his surgical guinea pigs. And that's what they were, because this was the work that was done on them. McIndoe was making it up as he went along.
Well, what you do is also bring the story to light about the nurses. So let's now talk about them. Their role has been overlooked. Were they, well, I'm not going to give you a Dorothy Dixer. Tell us about the attributes that Makino wanted them to have?
He wanted them, first of all, they had to be very good at their job. Not many of them had any plastic surgery experience at the time, but they just had to be very good nurses. The other thing was that they had to have a sense of humour and they had to be beautiful. And their sense of humour was important because the atmosphere in the ward was, imagine it, Philip, like the boys' dormitory in high school or even, you know, some rooms in a university. Lots of young men together, lots of bad language, lots of joking, lots of teasing. So they had to be able to handle that. And he wanted them to be beautiful and to be friendly and affectionate, really, towards the men. He wanted a total commitment.
Well, McIndoe's daughter told you that they had to be the sort of women who wouldn't make a fuss about having their bottoms pinched.
That's right. That's exactly right. And of course, they were not allowed to show any form of horror or disgust at the men. But he did. He wanted them to flirt. He wanted those men to feel that they could be loved again. And the very high spirits of the men meant that there was a very flirtatious atmosphere in the ward. It was a highly eroticized environment in that ward. You've got these desperate men, young men, you know, 20s, some of them not even 20, and young, beautiful women. And some of the women found it wonderfully liberating.
But not all of them. Tell us a story about Jane Lyons, who loved her 2 years at the hospital, but...
But she felt that, she said she learnt more about sex in that time than she ever knew before. Jane said something that many of them say, that she did things because of the environment. She started off feeling uncomfortable with it, but eventually got more relaxed about it. For many of them, many of the nurses, some really adapted to it well, but others were terrified. And many of them explain their compliance with this or the fact that they were coerced into sex in operating theatres at night or in the linen cupboard and so on, as doing their bit for the war. That many of them said to me, everybody had to do dreadful things in the war. I was unhappy doing this, but, you know, I was doing my bit for the war and it wasn't as bad as it could have been. But all of the women, even those who were very unhappy about it and felt scarred by the experience, loved the men. They were wonderful.
Let's contextualise this because... some women refused to recognise and claim unidentified unconscious men who'd arrived in the hospital and couldn't be identified because there were no fingerprints, there were smashed toothless jaws, noses that were burned away, empty eye sockets. So a terrified girlfriend, as you point out, could easily slip away by choosing not to identify the patient.
That's right, and it's believed that many did. And, of course, the men knew this. They knew that they were hideous to the women whom they'd loved before the war and hideous to any women that they might meet now. And so part of McIndoe's healing was to make these men feel better by surrounding them with beautiful women who treated them in a very special way. The men themselves say the women saved our lives. It was more than just the nursing. But, of course, for the nurses, for many of the nurses, that extra bit that you do for love was crippling and they felt shamed by it.
And yet, of course, the guinea pig club and the whole enterprise becomes quite famous.
It does. McIndoe was a tremendous advocate for his patients and he fought wildly for them throughout the time during the war and in the post-war years. The Guinea Pig Club is actually international. There were a lot of Canadians treated at East Grinstead. There were 690 members in all, some of whom were American, many were Canadian. There were about half a dozen Australians, some Poles, some Czechs, others. And what happened after it was first formed on that Sunday morning when everybody had a hangover was that they started to collect money because Geoffrey Page, one of the badly wounded pilots, decided that those of them who were well enough to go back to work should do something to help others who might not be able to earn a living after the war or after they were discharged from the hospital. And so a proper structure was set up for the club. And in 1943, there was a book published by, you might have read it at school, Philip. A lot of people your my age did, a book called The Last Enemy by Richard Hillary. Richard Hillary was one of McIndoe's guinea pigs, and he had previously had aspirations to become a journalist. And he wrote what really is seen as the equivalent of some of the great war poets. This is a very literary book as opposed to some of the more realist type memoirs that some of the other pilots and airmen wrote. Hillary's book was a very special book, and as soon as that book came out, money started to come into the hospital. So the club was set up. It's still going, although the members don't meet regularly anymore because many of them are too old to travel around. But it has supported them by getting them into work, supporting them when they couldn't work, now supports many of their widows.
And tell me about McIndoe's techniques. Are they still employed, are they still used, or have they simply been built upon?
Well, they have been built upon, and I think some are still used. He created a whole range of surgical equipment, much of which is still used today. His bugbear when he looked at what was happening to those men was the use of coagulants, which were applied to the burns. It was a jelly that you could spread over the face, like gentian violet and a substance called Tanifax. And it was used in order to cover the burned area and to keep out infection. And it did that. But it also was excruciating to remove because it set like a hard shell. And the men themselves told me that the pain of having that chipped away was worse than the burns themselves. What McIndoe did was to work on producing soft, moist pads covered with Vaseline, which kept the wound soft. And he discovered that the men who went down in the sea healed much better than those who went down on land, and he attributed that to the salt water. So he put saline baths in the ward. So this was a completely new process. The men would sometimes be in those lukewarm water baths with salt in them.
Okay, so he has a lot of arguments with the bureaucracy, but he finally wins through. I guess that's why he got the gong.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, it wasn't only what he did for the guinea pigs. You know, Fiona Wood, who did all the work on the barley burns victims, says that the work that they do today in plastic surgery can be attributed to the work that was done by McIndoe in those days. So, yes, I mean, it was quite extraordinary. And it was as though he saw those men. He did say that that he thought he was a fairly good surgeon until the first time he saw a young man with no eyelids and realized he would have to replace them, and he felt God come down his right arm. And he was an incredibly hard worker, absolutely devoted to these young men, and I think his extraordinary hard work and total commitment, it gave them the life that they would not have had otherwise.
Oh, extraordinary story. And what's your old hometown like now?
Well, parts of it are very much as it was, but well, I suppose it's like everywhere, isn't it? It can be very critical, but you know that spirit is still there, and the hometown has hung on to the guinea pigs. They have celebrated their treatment there every year. Since the end of the war.
Got to go, Liz. Look, thank you immensely. Liz Bursky's new book, In Love and War, Nursing Heroes. It's published this week by our friends at Fremantle Press. On our next, we'll be joined by someone called Shapiro. Who could he possibly be? Then we'll have a great discussion lined up about politicians, war and remembering with historians and authors Paul Hamm, James Brown and Claire Wright. And then we're going to take a peek at a new Indigenous musical, The New Black. It's time for the news now on RN. Talk to you soon.